let's turn to Revelation chapter 3. I hope that even though I keep turning to this passage, it's new to you every time, and it doesn't become a situation where you say, I wish he would jump over to the Old Testament or something else. And we have a nature that from time to time wants to do things like that. So hopefully we're continuing to learn some things, even though some of the things are being repeated. It's by design, because if you'll notice, even in commercials on television, I despise the things. They see the same thing over and over and over again. But you know why they do that? It's because it will. It'll get you in. I want to help, you know, install some of this information in such a way that it's like putting tools in a toolbox. And when the occasion comes that you need a certain tool, you got it, and you just go and pull it out. Well, ideas are like that. And when you learn, really learn what the Lord is saying in some of these verses, then it becomes a tool that you can use as his servant when you're talking with people. And the Lord, that the Spirit of God will bring to your remembrance things that you have learned because you've been faithful to come and to study the Word of God and to try to learn His Word and understand it so that you can explain it to people. And so that's the value of these things. But anyway, the 18th verse is where we've been looking. We've been trying to focus on something of the significance here, the fact that the people at the church at Laodicea were naked and didn't know it. They were naked. And he wanted to clothe them in white raiment, is what it says in verse 18. And so that stirs up to look at the bigger picture of the revelation of God, which takes us all the way back to the book of Genesis, and that's where we begin to pick up some thoughts on the subject of clothing. Why do we even wear clothes? And so we tried to address the question, why did Adam and Eve clothe themselves? And of course they were ashamed. They were naked. And it all carries the idea of shame because of the sinful effects that come into our life, which is shame. Paul talked about it in his letter to the Romans. What fruit had you then in those things wherein ye are now ashamed? And so he's talking about living, you know, in sin. There's a way that seemeth right to a man, but the end thereof are the ways of death. It always has an unexpected end. It doesn't turn out the way you think it's going to turn out. And yet we've got a nature in us that actually loves the way we think it's going to turn out, but it doesn't turn out that way. But the desire through human means and through human works, we can make it turn out good, even though God says it's not. We want it to turn out good because we want the truth to be what we want it to be. We want what's right to be what we want to be right. And we've been that way ever since we've been on this planet. We're all that way by nature. So we've got a nature problem. Well, anyway, sin brings shame. And so we looked at the issue in as delicate a way as we can, the parts of their body they covered. And so we're trying to see the significance of these things. And so I believe that what we have before us here is this conflict of worldviews that has been in place since the very beginning. One being that God created. He's the origin of life. But then there was another philosophy that we have learned in this church from a number of sources. I'm certain Pastor Kelly taught it in a number of messages he brought. But I think the one that really exposed a lot of the truth related to these things was Dr. Henry Morris. I'll tell you, been a many a time that I've sat there in my study looking out the window praying and thanking God for Henry Morris. I'll never forget when Pastor Kelly and I, just to throw a little local color into it, we went to Tampa, Florida to a Christian Educators Convention, and this was in about 1972, a long time ago. And it would be there that the Lord would allow our paths to cross. And we met Dr. Henry Morris. And as the years would go by, and I would read his books, there was a couple of times that I called him up, talked to him. And I was shocked that I could even do that, because he's such a giant. And the thing that's amazing about him is the humility that he had, to not know it. And I dial the phone number, and who answers the phone but Dr. Henry Morris? And so I get into this conversation with him, and he took time to spend with a simple farm boy that was trying to learn, you know, how to understand things. And myself come out of a world of confusion, because I had been in the university system here in North Carolina, where they tried to destroy my soul. And there's so many things I didn't understand. That man helped me. But anyway, he's one of the ones that introduced the idea that evolution actually had its origin in the Garden of Eden. And it was first presented by Satan. And the whole notion was that Jesus Christ and the person of Lucifer just emerged out of the chaos of existence, or nature as we know it today. And that somehow or other, maybe matter is eternal, and after billions and billions of years, and all of a sudden our personalities could spring into existence. Well, a lot of reasons to see that as absolutely foolish, but I believe Dr. Henry Morris is right. And so the two sources of origin that we're reading about here is either God created, or it's through natural means, which would be perpetuated through reproduction, human reproduction. And so when Adam and Eve sinned against God, they were basically declaring their independence from God. And if you declare your independence from God, if you're going to be logical and extend your logic as you should, from that premise or that conclusion that we do not need God, then you're going to have to figure out how you're going to be able to continue without him. How are you going to continue life without God? Well, to this day, many cultures believe that resurrection is through their children. In other words, we do all die, but I'm going to continue through my offspring and their offspring. And so resurrection or continuance of who we are is through our children and it's through human reproduction. But if you're going to separate yourself from God, I'm going to tell you something. That's true. That's the only continuance you'll ever have. And simple logic would, I think, verify that. And so you're either going to live abiding in the vine, or you're going to separate yourself from the vine, and here you go. You're on your own. And so how can you have life without God? And is it not the case that we were born, every one of us, attempting to live that very way without God? None of us were abiding in the vine. I wasn't. You weren't. We all know it. And it practically destroyed us. But by the grace of God, he allowed us to survive our own foolishness. And by his grace, he sent somebody to us to tell us the truth, bring the gospel. And some of you can probably sit there right now and say, well, the person that was most instrumental in me getting saved was, and you can probably name them. I can. Who was the first person to come to you and influence you in an important way to give your life to Christ that resulted in you eventually turning around and doing that very thing? We're not going to go any more into that part, but I do want to go back to the 60s revolution and throw in a few more thoughts about that. Because I want us to think about how current the philosophy in the Garden of Eden was with our day. Because the 60s was, I mean, to me it doesn't seem like it was that long ago. I was a college student during the 60s, and I was telling you about being out at Berkeley and a number of other places I visited, not only in this country, but over in Europe. And I'm telling you, there was a revolution that was global in the 60s. Absolutely global. And so here I was, this student trying to find my way and learn my own identity. That's what we're really after, identity. We're trying to be somebody. Everybody wants to be somebody. And everybody wants to be important, to be significant, to have a meaningful life and a purpose. Everybody has that. It's a powerful drive in us. And so back in the 60s, what had happened was in the university, evolutionism and the teaching of Darwin had begun to overshadow what the churches were teaching, to the point that students in the college were being told that Christianity is not reasonable, it's not rational. It's just a faith. It's a faith in something that can be and cannot be investigated. You don't even have the tools to do it with. You can't see the invisible. You can't investigate the invisible. You can't prove the invisible. You cannot even disprove the invisible. It's unknown and it's unknowable. That's called agnosticism. And technically they were right. Technically they were right. And the Bible says they were right. Paul said it to the Romans. He was a philosopher schooled at the feet of Gamaliel. He's the one that warned us about being spoiled through philosophy and vain deceit after the rudiments of the world and not after Christ. He was a philosopher. He had read the philosophers. I believe that he was as familiar with Plato and Socrates and Aristotle as students today who go to college and study the same material. He knew about those things. And Paul wrote the Romans. And he said, say not in thine heart, who shall ascend up into the heavens? That is to bring Christ or bring truth down. Folks, listen. That is the time period of Grecian philosophy, and a statement that would describe it if there ever has been. Because this is what they were trying to do. They were trying through intellectual powers to ascend up and bring truth down, and they couldn't do it. Couldn't do it. And that's again why Pilate asked the question in the court trial, what is truth? He didn't know. He had read the philosophers too. He read them. Philosophy during that time period between the Grecian Empire and the Roman Empire was at its zenith. It was at its very height. And to this day, we still read those thinkers. Most of them lived within a 30-mile radius of Athens, Greece. And they were the greatest thinkers of human history in terms of secular education, as far as that's concerned. And so when the Romans conquered these Greeks, the Grecian Empire was so successful in their exploits that the Middle East was speaking Greek because of all the schools that Alexander the Great set up all around. And in all of that effort was the inclusion of the philosophers. And it's very important for us to understand this, and this is why I keep repeating it, because it's so vital. This information is so vital. I believe in witnessing to people that these are things that you can use one day. People will come to you and say, why is the Old Testament in Hebrew and the New Testament in Greek? We can say it's because of the influence of Alexander the Great and the Grecian Empire and the Byzantine Empire. And so when Pilate asked that question, you cannot understand why he asked that question, what is truth, if you do not understand the connection between the Grecian Empire and the Roman Empire and the tremendous influence the Grecian Empire had upon the entire world from then on to this very day. Well, it impacted the Roman Empire too. And so we come to the 60s and we discover the truth of what Paul was saying once again. Say not in thine heart, who shall ascend up, like the philosophers tried to do, and bring Christ down. And so during the Age of Enlightenment, 1800s time period, a group of thinkers got together and said, we're wasting our time. And the proof of it is Plato, Socrates, and Aristotle. Everybody knows. Pilate knew it. Everybody knows. They failed. They didn't answer the question. They did not define truth. They just absolutely failed. And so let's not think that way anymore. We're just wasting mental energy doing that. So let's focus upon what we do know. Well, that's what existentialism is all about. It's what the study of existing things is all about, which is what existentialism is. So we're here today and we've learned, and hopefully after repeating it two or three times, we're learning a word that we can include in our vocabulary, and that's not a bad word to know in our day. It's an important word to know in our day. Existentialism. It has to do with existence and the study of existence and the concentration of this country of ours upon that philosophy that has brought us to this point of ruination that we're experiencing right now. And so, again, in the mid-1800s, Darwin comes along with his theory of biological evolutionism and offers the world of thinking people an alternative to the Creator. And listen, are we seeing the big picture? A repeat of history? That the very thing that took place in the 1800s in America was the same thing that happened in the Garden of Eden? The contest over, did God create or did man evolve? And lo and behold, it's with us now. And in the public school system, that's what they have in the textbooks. And churches are not preaching. They're not preaching and explaining the problem of the revolution of the 60s. It's not being done. And I believe it's because a lot of preachers are too busy preaching other preachers' sermons and not studying the Bible. And not asking the Lord to show them the big picture. The big picture. You know, in having the Bible that takes us all the way back, listen to this, all the way back to Genesis, and then takes us all the way past our day into the future. Does God somehow or other want us to see the big picture or something? That He would give us a book from the beginning to the ending? And the answer is absolutely. He's given us the big picture. And so, as we study the Bible from beginning to end, there comes a point where the pieces of the puzzle begin to come together so that you can see God's program, His prophetic program. And we find ourselves right here in this Laodicean period, so descriptive of our day when it comes to the churches, where people are sitting back comfortable, basically having need of nothing because they're rich and increased with goods. And it's kind of like, so I was telling somebody the other day, the Chinaman that came over to America to visit, and after he had visited a while, he's a Christian man, and he goes back, and somebody asked him, what most impressed you about your trip to America? And he said, I suppose that the thing that impressed me the most was, it's what great things Americans could accomplish without God. I don't know where I heard that, but I still remember it. It made an impression on me. Because that is a picture of the Laodicean church. They didn't need God. He was outside the church, knocking on the door, wanting to get in. They didn't need Him. And the reason they didn't need Him and call on Him was because they had need of nothing. Because thou sayest, I am rich and increased with goods and have need of nothing. And knowest not, from my perspective, Thou art wretched and miserable and poor and blind and naked. Naked. And so naked that the churches tried to blend, now listen to this, tried to blend creation and evolutionism. Tried to pull it together. It's called theistic evolution. And so this was one of the big things with the Scofield Bible and the gap theory. You see the big picture? You see how this fits in there? You see how great men of God, and Scofield was a great man of God, he was deceived. He was deceived. And I tell you why he was deceived is because he was made to feel small by the intellectuals that were embracing Darwin and saying, Darwin's got something. And he's saying he's got evidence for evolution. And it began to creep into the church so that a Scofield would receive it. Hook, line, and sinker. Theistic evolution. And the preachers were not, they were not on duty. They were not studying this book. And they were robbing God of the glory that belonged to him. And they were trying to credit man with and his creation with glory that belonged exclusively to him. God didn't need nature to accomplish his ends. He spoke. And it was done. He spoke. And it was done. And so, when you get to the 60s, the kids started running around naked. And nobody understood why, really. They just thought they were, you know, young people that were just out being wild like a lot of young people are from time to time. And it was more of a, I don't know what you'd call it, just something to talk about. People doing things to get noticed, because everybody was trying to do that, you know, to get some kind of identity so that a person could say, I'm important. And that's what fashions are all about. That's what the tattoos, the weird hairstyles, the different color hair, the rings in the eyebrows and bolts in the tongue and through the lips and every other kind of weird thing. What's that all about? It's the quest for identity. And when other people do a certain thing, well, I can be part of the group by doing the same thing. And so I can find identity by maybe joining the Elks Club or joining the Moose Club or becoming a Mason or going to the Presbyterian Church or the Baptist Church. It's identity. So much of it has to do with identity. When Brother Kent was called to preach here and the decision was being made about what we're going to call this place, he revolted against those that were trying to get him to put Baptist in the on the Sinai here. Because he understood something about the identity quest and the problem of it. And he didn't want people to come to this church because it was a Baptist church. He wanted people to identify with only one thing, Jesus Christ and the cross of Calvary. And he said, this place is going to be called Calvary Memorial Church. That's the history of this place, K Calvary Memorial Church. This is going to be called Calvary Memorial Church. We're not going to have people coming here identifying with a denomination. There are people who actually think they're going to heaven because of their affiliation with a denomination. There are Catholic churches that teach it as plain as can be. If you're not a member of the Catholic Church, that's your only way to heaven. Got to be a member there. Oh, yeah. Baptist, too. Oh, yeah. It is. And so we need to begin that. We need to see the big picture of what's going on. Well, the thing about the 60s was these were not just people out here trying to find identity and trying to say, look at me, I'm special, I'm naked, I'm running across the campus. They were not just doing that. No, it was deeper. It was deeper. And the deeper reason was, who says naked is naked? Did God say that naked was naked? Yes, he did. But I don't believe that God created. I believe that what Darwin taught was right. After all the schools are teaching it. How did we begin? Well, there was a big bang. And then there was billions and billions of years. And we've got the evidence right here. We can show you the pictures in the book of, you know, the mud hole, the first little thing that crawled out of it, and then grew legs, and then climbed up in a tree, and on it goes. As though some photographer was there photographing it as it happened. Folks, it's all a lie. It's all an absolute lie. It's a lie of the devil. And the churches were asleep and not teaching the truth. And so the young people were saying, okay, if we're going to outlaw God and look at these Christians as people who just believe in this invisible dimension that you can't prove at all, if we're going to be really intellectuals that look for facts as a basis for believing, then we have to look at what Darwin had to say, because that's true science. It's the systematic investigation of observable phenomena. Well, I'll tell you something, that's not true. True science is not the systematic investigation of observable phenomena. It isn't. True science is that God, the Creator, came down. We don't have to ascend up anymore and bring Christ down, because he came down right by himself without our aid any whatsoever. He chose to come down. He was born in Bethlehem's manger. And he grew up and provided us what the humanists said in the 60s the church was void of. And that's fact and evidence. And he came down and he proved who he was. Now, if he proves something, are we going to come along and trump that and say, well, unless we prove you, then you're not real? That's foolish, folks. If Jesus Christ comes down and proves his identity, we don't have to prove anything. It's already been proven. So we don't have to prove anything. The evidence is here. We already have it. This is what the church has failed to teach, is that God came down and gave us the proof. And when Luke wrote Theophilus in Acts, Chapter 1, verse 3. Think about the words. Think about the words. After his passion, for 40 days, he showed himself alive. We didn't prove him to be alive. he showed himself alive by many infallible proofs. He proved it. He proved it. We do not have the burden of proving God. We do not have to be like the philosophers and ascend up and try to bring the evidence down. The evidence came down, and he proved himself. And we've got the facts, and the evolutionists have nothing. Nothing. There's no evidence. I had a class yesterday. It just thrills my soul to stand in front of people and say, I can prove to you that evolution is a lie. People sit out there. There's one of them that was there yesterday in the class who was a pre-med student. He made a statement in the class that his whole background was in science. At a certain point in the class, he spoke up and said something that sort of, I think, helped reinforce, actually immensely, some of the things that had been said. But he said, my background is science, and I agree with everything you've said. And so I talked about biogenesis and first and second law of thermodynamics and the law of irreducible complexity and the law of non-contradiction and a few things like that, and said, listen, these are axioms of science. And every single one of them deny evolution's possibility. And then I jumped over and said, I can prove to you that the Bible is exactly what it claims to be. I can prove it to you. And the reason is because the Creator gave me the basis for doing it. He gave it to me. He gave it to all of us. We've got the facts. And it's time for us to stop feeling small and come out boldly. Come out boldly. And call a lie, and the truth. And not being ashamed. That's our responsibility as Christians. So in the 60s, they started running around naked, and the reason, and they're still doing it to this day, we've got a real problem with this. You got these boys going around with their pants. Have you seen them attached to some kind of underwear that actually covers up everything? And they got it attached in such a way that the pockets go way down below the bottom, and they're walking around. This is just, a method of keeping from being locked up, but doing the same thing as streaking. That's what it's all about. They know they'll get arrested if they go around actually naked on the streets out here, because people have not accepted this yet, that nakedness is okay. And so we're going to get as close to the border of nakedness and what people call shame, which we don't believe is shame at all. We don't believe it's shame. These are people that are shaking their fists in the face of God and saying, you call it naked. We don't think it's wrong. You think it's wrong, but we don't think it's wrong. And so these rebels are running around here like that. I saw one down at Walmart the other day. I tell you what, there's many a time, I know I shouldn't think this way, but I'm going to have to expose myself. I would that I was as big as some of those guys that work out at Gold's Gym. Huge, like 250 pounds, just solid rock. I'd like to be down there at Walmart, pick me up one of those boat paddles down there, come up behind me, go, pow! And just see the smoke rise up. And then just look at them and say, you got a problem?
You got a problem. Pull your pants up.
Yeah, pull your pants up. You don't want some more of that. Don't let me see you like that again. I'll tell you what, if I was... That's probably not Christian, but feels good just saying it. But anyway, in the 60s, if you are educated into believing that man is a biological evolution, then you have to follow the logic of that, because there's a logical extension of both views. And if God does not exist, and Darwin is right, then Jesus Christ, the very best that you can make out of him as a personality, even if he ever existed, is that he was maybe a good man, went around, said some good stuff, but he was not God. Well, here's the logic. If a man goes around claiming to be God and he's not God, he's insane. I don't care how you try to think about it or describe it. If Jesus Christ is not exactly who he said he was an absolute lunatic by anybody's definition. He was not a good person. He was a deceiver. He was a liar. So it's an either-or situation. He was either exactly who he said he was, or he was a fraud. And if he was a fraud, the Bible is a myth. You had a bunch of idiots, useful idiots, following a person who was schizophrenic. If Jesus Christ was not God, he was out of contact with reality, which is what the definition of schizophrenia is. It's a person that's out of contact with reality. And so it's very important for us to see that this is how sharp the line is drawn when it comes to what the Bible teaches. It's either all true or it's all a lie. And there's no in between. Well, the kids in the school, with the help of the state, Antichrist state church, was being educated into believing that it was all a lie. And if you follow the logic, it has to be all a lie. We're on our own. We're on our own. There's no God to save us. If there's any salvation, we have to save ourselves. We have to save ourselves.
Brother Creeks, the fruit of that teaching, sitting in the White House.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And in the government now. Mm-hmm. The region of the United States and the world, Europe. Mm-hmm. That is the fruit of what mm-hmm. has come from the mm-hmm. 1960s. Mm-hmm. Right. Except what
you mean. Yeah. You see, that's exactly right. You see, our entire culture, our entire way of life hangs in the balance over which view you're going to embrace and teach in your schools. Everything. Think about it. If you throw the Bible out and say that it's not real, it's not true, and that Darwin is right, then what's wrong with the LGBTQ crowd? What's wrong with it? Nothing. If there is no God, what makes a four-letter word a bad word? The answer is nothing. No such thing as a bad word. If there is no God, why should you stand in a church and enter into a covenant with a woman that you're going to live with her until death you do part? There really ain't a reason to do that. As a matter of fact, there's not even a reason to get married. Who said you should marry? Who is it that says you can't just go around and have sex with anybody that wants to have sex with you? And that's what the state of North Carolina is doing by handing out the condoms and stuff like that to all sexually active children, regardless of age, which is the language in the Blue Book. Signed by Governor Jim Hunt. I've got it in my office. I was a counselor with the state just before all of that got written. And I was already implementing that philosophy, at least I was supposed to. I didn't, because I was Christian, I was saved. I wasn't going to put that stuff out there and counsel children that it was not wrong to have sex outside of marriage. But I was supposed to tell them as a state counselor that sex outside of marriage was all right, as long as it was safe sex and with consent. And as long as it was with consent and it was safe, you took precautions against preventing disease, then the state had no problem with it. Why would they take that position? Because that's Darwinian evolution up one side and down the other. And it's this in the face of God who says, fornicators shall have their part in the lake that burns with fire. And he says that about the effeminate. He says that about homosexuals. So there is no middle ground on this. And it's time for people that are Christians to understand how clear the lines are drawn. It's as clear as light and darkness. Is that clear? Is that clear? And if we would just basically come out of the closet, you see that the homosexuals have pushed Christians into the closet. They used to be in the closet. But Christians are now in the closet. And we need people, Christians, that will come out into the broad open daylight and say, this is the truth. And I can prove it. We ought to say that. I can prove it. Not because we have the wherewithal to prove it within and of ourselves as though we originated the means. No. Because God himself gave us the evidence to do it with. He did it. He provided it by the life that he lived. The most unrefutable, authentic fact in the course of human history is the birth, the life, the death, the resurrection, and ascension of Jesus Christ. And so, in the 60s, fornication became a way of life. Lasciviousness became a way of life. Four-letter words began to creep into the theater. Nude scenes on the theater screen. Why? Because there's nothing wrong with it. According to the philosophy that had been accepted by this nation. And it's a good time to insert, the wicked shall be turned into hell and all the nations that forget God. And we're so close to it, you can almost feel it. The wrath of God. Not only upon this nation, but the whole world. Our time is gone in 3 minutes. I want to read you something right quick. Got this off the internet. 6,000 Colombians get naked for massive group photo project. Colombians down in South America. It was 46 degrees Fahrenheit outside, but that didn't stop 6,000 Colombians from stripping off their clothes. A New York-based photographer, Spencer Tunick, asked locals to take a massive nude group photograph at a large plaza in the country's capital. The volunteers, ignoring the chilly weather, stripped down to the Boulevard Plaza in Bogota for the famed photographer, who is known for his nude photos in public places. It was Tunick's largest art project in 6 years and the first one in Bogota. Well, I'll tell you what, there's a lot of useful idiots out here in the world. And Tunick told the agents, France Press, that it was all in the name of peace. All in the name of peace. Peace. No need to read any more. We got a problem in the whole world. Whole world. The whole world has chosen against God. The whole world. And that's why we're on the very precipice, what you might say, of the 7 years of tribulation, where God's wrath is going to be poured out upon the whole world. And as we continue into the book of the Revelation, we're going to see that what the Lord describes there in judgment is the whole world. The whole world hates God. Wide is the gate, broad is the way that leads unto destruction, and many there be that go in therein. Well, our time's gone. Let's look to the Lord in prayer. Alan, why don't you dismiss us this morning?